Hey, and welcome back to the fifth and final part of our interview with philosopher Ken Wilber. In this part, we discuss the potential flaws of the integral theory and the integral movement, as well as the problems with charismatic leaders who have a lot of unchecked shadow material. You can find all the links, show notes, and videos for this entire interview series at futurethinkers.org/Ken Wilber.
And just a quick reminder that we're closing the registration for the Future Thinkers membership in 2 days. So hurry up before Friday, January 24th, and get access to all of our courses, our private group calls, Q&As, and more. Go to futurethinkers.org/register.
Hey, and welcome to futurethinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to futurethinkers.org/start. When you look back on your body of work and your experiences with putting all these things into practice or communicating them to people, what do you think you got wrong?
Okay. One that I have written about myself actually has to do with what is sometimes referred to as the model that I had developed in Wilber One. In other words, the first couple of books that I did. And what I was trying to do, the reason I actually got in to those writing at all, but certainly writing those first books, is I was finishing my degree in graduate studies. It was in biochemistry. And I had just started to look at some other areas besides natural science in terms of, you know, any truth they might have or just what was going on. So there were things like Gestalt therapy that I had heard of. There was this thing, Zen Buddhism, that I had started to practice a few years earlier, having read Suzuki's books on Zen Buddhism. I just really started a very sort of aggressive search through all of our various cultures, from pre-modern times to modern times to post-modern times, and in the East and in the West. And I was really looking for, you know, something like an ultimate truth or an ultimate reality, or if that even made any sense. And as I was checking these areas out, and I was reading, again, some stuff that Eastern stuff, Western stuff, pre-modern stuff, modern stuff. And often, if there was still some sort of modern practice that was connected to it, then I would actually go out and try to find somebody who was teaching that. Now I wanted to actually practice it. I wanted to actually try it myself. So I would have a more dependable idea about what that particular approach was like. And somewhere towards the end of that initial process, I just had a kind of a Satori-like experience. And we talked a little bit about it earlier in this conversation. But I had gone from thinking there was just one correct approach, and everybody else didn't have the correct approach, so they had the incorrect approach. World of opposites. So there's the true, and there's everything else that's false. And that change from asking, okay, what's the one true approach versus all the others that are wrong, to saying, okay, how do all of these fit together? Because all of them have some partial degree of truth. And I knew that, and certainly for the ones that I had actually been practicing, because I knew I was getting something out of every one of those practices. There was some sort of truth in every one of them. And I couldn't just be convinced to throw them all over. I mean, I'd even run out and found somebody who was doing psychoanalytic-oriented psychotherapy. I was actually doing a type of psychoanalysis. So that just changed my orientation rather profoundly. I had not yet done a really in-depth study of developmental studies, developmental psychology. So I hadn't yet done that book, for example, that did an analysis of over 100 types of developmental models and found what they had in common. But what I was doing is I was working with levels as part of the framework that was helping to bring all these things together. Because that's one of the ways that I found could help fit things together. So I'll give you just a very brief idea. We talked about cleaning up, how you take the a narrow and reduced psyche that's repressed some of its own shadow material, and then you unite that fractured psyche with that shadow, and so you make a whole healthy psyche. So that was one level, is you go from a small split mind, and then you unite that with shadow, and that would give you a whole and healthy mind. So that was one degree of wholeness. It was greater. During the 60s, there was a huge movement in psychology and psychotherapy that was known by a lot of names, but technically it was called humanistic existential. And one of the main claims that it made is that human beings often have this really bad split between mind and body. And they identify with the mind, and the body is just dangling along under them. And so a lot of these humanistic existential therapies would come up with practices where you'd actually unite your mind and body, and you'd get a whole healthy organism. So, well, okay, I bought that. I had tried some of those. They certainly seemed to work and to do that. So that was a bigger level of wholeness. So you take the broken mind plus shadow, get the whole healthy mind. Then you take the whole healthy mind, unite it with the body, and you get the whole healthy organism. That's even bigger. So that was another level. And there were levels between these things. And then the mystics all claimed that, no, you're not just this individual organism, that there's an experience where this individual organism becomes one with absolutely the entire world. And I'd go, well, that's a big, big wholeness. So that's going to go on the bottom. That's going to be the biggest. So then you go from just identified with a small broken mind to a whole healthy mind to a whole healthy organism to identified with the whole universe. And that was the whole, man, that was big. That was the ultimate level of identity we could have. Now, what came from that? Well, and I that sort of hit me, that whole series of levels sort of hit me in a big insight. And so I wrote my first book using those levels. And the book was called, appropriately enough, The Spectrum of Consciousness. And the idea was that human beings didn't just have a consciousness. It was just at a level. And that's what was real, and you can work on that, do different things to it, and so on. But that we actually had a whole spectrum of levels of consciousness, and these varied from very, very small and broken to unbelievably whole and unified. And essentially, that's a correct insight. But the problem at that early stage for me is that I hadn't yet looked at how development itself moves. But by the way, I'd come up with about 6 or 7 major levels. And then what I did is I went through, and next to all of these levels, I would give typical examples of the types of disciplines that worked with each different level. So you could see how all human knowledge fit alongside this big spectrum and all of that. And on balance, most of it was very solid and very good, and it was a very, very, relatively very new concept. And so it got just outrageous positive reviews. But the one area I hadn't directly dealt with was development itself. And since taking just this model on its own, we have this ultimate unity, and it's broken into a smaller unity, and then that's broken into a smaller one, and then that's broken to an even smaller one. Well, that would suggest that in terms of development, that's how development itself would go. It would go in those stages, because, I mean, how would it start with the smaller one and have these things happen? Or it certainly wouldn't start in the middle. So, but I noticed in that book, when I would write about something like the infant The assumption would be, if our development is starting with this big wholeness, that the infinite itself starts out one with everything. And so when I got to writing about that, I noticed that I would just sidestep that whole issue. And I just didn't deal with that. And so the model itself was, in essence, it was right. But in terms of some of the actual stages and then the direction that they would go, that would await Wilbur too. And what happened with that is I started writing. I wanted to apply this model. I wrote, actually, the first book, The Spectrum of Consciousness, was a large, somewhat academic book. And so I wrote a very popular, accessible version of that called No Boundary. And No Boundary is still one of the best-selling books that I've done. And it's essentially okay. But here was the problem. I decided I wanted to take that six or so level model, and I was going to apply it to human history, human evolution, and show how that had all occurred. And I was going to apply it to human development and show how the same levels occurred as an infant, you know, grew and developed. And the problem was, well, at first I didn't think there was a problem, because everybody at that time, well, everybody knew that the first 6 months or so of an infant's life, that it actually is one with its physical environment. It can't tell where its body stops and the floor starts. And Freud was aware of this. Piaget was aware of this. And it was just a type of fusion state. And so to me, that was pretty clear that was an example of this unity, this big wholeness. And then the infant would start breaking those down. First, it would separate its whole organism from the environment. And that would be the next level. And then it would, as it conceptually developed, it would separate its mind from its body. And that would be the next level. And then when it got shadow material, that would separate, you know, the broken, shrunken mind from the whole mind. So I thought that was all working fine. But then the more I looked at that first stage of development, which was supposed to be wholeness, the more it dawned on me that something was just not right about that. And so I started writing a book that was going through all the stages of human development, starting with this whole unity and then going all the way through the emergence of a small psyche, which I call persona versus shadow. And then from there, we went into stages of meditation and enlightenment. And that was where it was starting to get problematic when you do that. But as I looked at that early infantile state, I was actually writing a book on that, and I'd actually written a chapter on that early state. And the book that I was writing was called The Outman Project. And what started to dawn on me was that there's something really off about those first few stages, that it was really hard to make that work. And so I thought, well, what I'll do is, I was going to do a book on human history, so I'll do that now. I'll go back and look at human history. And that'll help me figure it out, because you can see, you know, adult human beings and what they were doing and all of that. But when I first went back and started looking at all the material, literally most of the really smart scholars at the time that also had a mystical interest, people like Norman O'Brien or even people like Alan Watts, had maintained that the Garden of Eden was a real place, that in the Garden of Eden, we were one with everything. So they were telling the same story about, well, it all starts out with this absolute whole unified oneness, and then it got broken off and broken off and broken off, and we got smaller and smaller and smaller. And that started to make sense for me. But then I just ran across this one explanation about the Garden of Eden. And this person just used a couple words, and they were, the Garden of Eden wasn't a transpersonal state. It was a prepersonal state. And that just hit me like a bolt of lightning. And I actually ended up, because of that understanding, the difference between pre and trans, I actually ended up writing a paper that had a very, very wide circulation, a huge impact at the time. And it was called the pre-trans fallacy. And what that is, it just said, if you look at any sort of mystical approaches to reality, what they'll often do is they'll just say, okay, there's rationality, that's bad, and then there's non-rational, and that's good. But they don't distinguish between pre-rational and trans-rational. And they don't distinguish between pre-verbal and trans-verbal. And pre-rational is not good. That really is just pure narcissistic, self-centered, and so on. Trans-rational, now that's good, because that transcends and includes rationality. So I went back and looked again at those early stages, and particularly as I read, for example, Piaget more closely, he actually said of that first stage, that fusion stage, he said the self is here material, so to speak. In other words, the self is identifying with just the material environment. It wasn't in the Christian mystical version of the great chain of being, matter to body, to mind, to soul, to spirit. The child wasn't identifying with feeling, body, or mental concepts, or illuminated soul, or ultimate spirit. It was just identifying with the material environment around it, and that's all it was. So that just flipped those early periods on their head, so to speak. And then actually looking at more complete sort of chain of being that I had constructed by using Eastern and Western sources, you could see that human beings essentially started out in those lower stages and then progressed through all of these levels of growing up. So that was a big change for me. And even though, again, Shambhala Publications, which is who I've done a lot of publishing, is distributed by Random House Publications. And Random House has got the largest publishing and book marketing force on the planet. And they distribute all of these books. So it's really the best of all possible worlds. And Random House decided at some point, I don't know, 45 years or something like that, that they wanted to do collected works of Ken Wilber. And I immediately thought, well, that means I died, because you never do collected works until somebody's dead. But I finally said, okay, fine. So we brought the works together at that time, which are really only about 2/3 of my collected works, but it was done in 8 volumes of like about 2 books in this volume. So I went back and read everything that I had written. And all of those books are still in print, by the way, which is really kind of unheard of for that time. And I particularly was curious about the spectrum of consciousness, because it was the first thing I had written. I wrote it when I was 23 years old, and I hadn't really looked back at it carefully in a long time. And so I went back and read it really, really carefully. And what was so odd is that whenever I got to a point where I was just about to say something unbelievably false and really screwed up, because this model wasn't quite fitting the way it should. And so I was going to say something about, you know, a 6-month infant is at a state of enlightened oneness, only it's in a pre-conscious fashion. It'll recapture that oneness in a mature adult form later on if it takes up meditation. So right when I would be about to say that, I would steer off it and I wouldn't actually say something quite that bad. But it did leave a hole in the narrative, so to speak. Because it really tended to pick the story of growth up at the persona shadow, this narrow, narrow stage of development. And that's really about halfway up what I would call the overall spectrum now. And the thing that I hadn't figured out was what those really earliest stages of human development were like. And this was a problem both because so many of the smart, mystically oriented philosophers that I had read bought into the fact that this early fusion state was indeed an enlightened awareness, just in an unconscious way, whatever the hell that meant. And there were very serious models being written that said exactly that, and claimed to be based on this work that I was doing. But I never had actually said that. And by the time I got to Atman Project, because I went back, and as I was doing the historical account of humanity, which was a book that I called Up from Eden, and it was given that name up from Eden because Eden really was a pre-rational, pre-verbal, pre-personal state. And we didn't fall down from that. We grew up from that. And so both of these books were then absolutely fine and essentially stayed with the main central framework that I had presented ever since. But I was always surprised that I had essentially, in essence, even though I didn't use very many of these types of philosophy themselves, but I had essentially fallen into a version of romantic philosophy, that we really were in an Eden and we really did go downhill from that point of view. And that's just not quite what happened. One of the things that did happen is that when we were in that pre-rational, pre-verbal Eden period, way back in so-called archaic to magic times, there wasn't a very strong separate self sense. So we didn't really have that sense of being isolated and separated from the world. We didn't have the sense that we had actually fallen as human beings. But as we got more sophisticated and moved up into the mythic stages, where you do start to develop a stronger sort of separate self sense or ego, then we start to get stories about humanity falling from a period where it was a heavenly, you know, blissful state. And that was just looking back on the period, not where they were actually enlightened or awakened, but where they were just too pre-conscious to be aware of very much of this separate and horrifying pain of being a separate self-sense in the manifest world. Remember, even Buddhism maintains that the inherent mark of this manifest world is dukkha. It's inherently suffering. And that's what you get if you go around splitting everything up into opposites and trying to keep them apart, and you separate yourself apart from your ground of being, which is your own ultimate truth. Go around doing that a lot, and you're in for a world of hurt. So that was a big change for me. But it always surprised me that that I had done that. So that's pretty straightforward in a sense.
The brand new Future Thinkers members portal is now live. Develop your sovereignty and self-knowledge with our in-depth courses, get access to our weekly sense-making calls, join the Q&As with past podcast guests, and much more. Become a Future Thinkers member today at futurethinkers.org/members. What about the integral movement? Do you think that there are certain things that kind of either went wrong or could have been done better? And maybe can still be done better.
Yeah, sure. I want to put this politely. One of the things that can happen when a fairly developed individual first reads some of my books is that, and this is only, I don't know, maybe 10, 15%, a little more, a little less. It's not a huge number, but it's a significant number. It's because they haven't been exposed to a lot of these various areas of truth and their own potential for growing. They can become extremely excited about it. And the way they become excited about it is not the way a sort of a more fully and rounded, developed person would do it, but just somebody who has really sort of pushed their cognitive development into second tier, even though their self-sense and their moral development and so on might be much lower than that. But cognitively, they're pushing into this sort of integral second tier. And so they get very, very excited about this approach. And what they get especially excited about is the fact that they are at this vanguard of growth and development. Even though they're not doing so well in other areas, and they might never have, you know, and they don't care about waking up or anything like that. But they do know they're at second tier. and that's the leading edge, and that's where humanity is struggling to get to right now, and that so many things are going to be better when humanity gets there, and so on. All of that's true. But what's not true is that you're not necessarily a sterling representative of all this. And development anyway, it certainly in growing up, and we just saw waking up gets more and more complex as you continue going into it. But it looks like right now that growing up can just sort of keep going. There doesn't seem to be an actual upper limit to that. So, I mean, if we look back 1,000 years ago, humans weren't all that developed in growing up. So where are we going to be 1,000 years from now? We're going to look back on us, or the super intelligent machines will look back on us, their forerunners, and decide that we're not that necessarily bright. But what would happen is some of those types of people, and then let me just say, so nobody reads into between the lines here, not the people that actually put on most of the integral conferences. I'm not talking about those people, but I am talking about the 15% or so that attended those conferences and thought that they themselves were, you know, one of the great, great exemplars of this leading edge that we're all looking for. And those types of folks, they just caused problems as far as I could see. And I personally just wasn't very happy with how that was going. And so I myself never attended a single integral conference that was held in any of these other areas. And I never got on in a chat room or a discussion board where there were some of these types of people that were on it. And in most of the discussion, you could always find a handful that were doing that. And so they were always sort of explaining to everybody how they should be acting. They knew exactly how they should be thinking. And they knew exactly what the right thing to do was and whatnot. And I just found that really disturbing. I mean, that's really what an overall integrated, integral person, that's exactly what they're not going to do. And they really do lead with a certain kind of humility. And they're very good at gratefulness, and they're very good at forgiveness. And these are values that rank very high for people that are genuinely well developed. And again, there's in a certain sense there's no reason to get braggadocio about maybe your cognitive development is second tier, because again, development can just keep continuing. So there's always going to be somebody who's at a stage higher than you are. And there's always going to be somebody that's had more waking up experiences than you have. So what you should really take away from a fully integral approach is, wow, there are more areas than I dreamt of that I can fail at. So I really got to get my act together. Look at all these places I can continue to grow. That's a good attitude to have. And how you're already there and already understanding all that, good Lord, I don't know anybody that fits that sort of orientation. But integral sometimes, and I think particularly from the sort of chat room conversations, it wasn't uncommon to hear that kind of criticism. Is that, oh, well, they're all arrogant, they're all know-it-alls, you know, and that kind of thing. And that was not at all anything that I had in mind for that sort of comprehensive approach.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about people who might be very cognitively developed or might have had awakening experiences, but they still have a lot of shadow material, so they haven't done a whole lot of cleaning up. And they cause a different kind of brand of trouble, you know, different kinds of cult abuse, guru abuse, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And it's a real problem because, again, just even talking about growing up and waking up and cleaning up, there is no major school of waking up that includes growing up and cleaning up. That's the problem. And certainly none of the traditional approaches do. As we were saying, growing up and cleaning up are really only discovered about 100 years ago. And most of the spiritual traditions were already quite formed by that time. All the meditation traditions were in existence. All the stages of meditation were already laid out. And yet none of those systems have any understanding of growing up or cleaning up. And that's a real problem. Again, as we saw, you'll interpret any meditative waking up you have in terms of the stage of growing up you're at. And so if you don't know that, that's a problem. And if you haven't actually done some sort of cleaning up work, you have some degree of shadow material. And that can really be a problem, particularly in spiritual groups. And the things that we call cultic groups, almost always charismatic leaders that have huge shadow elements. And so they're power-driven, or they're sexually abusing female students, or they're socking money away in a Swiss bank account. And this is just all straightforward shadow material. And it particularly became problematic in the late 60s and early 70s, when largely because the Beatles introduced the world to transcendental meditation, all of a sudden meditation was a hot item. And it was just starting to show up everywhere. And Eastern teachers were pouring into the West at a huge rate, including very, very good ones, and many that were really problematic. And one of the things that really made it kind of explosive is that in most of the Eastern countries where these teachers were from, if they're from Japan, for example, they had fairly regulated moral background that they had to operate within. So if you were a Zen master in Japan, you really weren't allowed to go around abusing your female students. Something like that would be found out. You would be reported to your own superiors. And that's going to be a real problem if you're doing that. So it's much stricter kind of background moral codes. When those teachers landed in Los Angeles, it was like all bets are off and anything is allowed. And a lot of these teachers, particularly male, went nuts. And sexual abuse just became rampant. There was a really crash and burn of a fair number of Eastern teachers. And what that generation had to do, what those boomers had to do, was really rewrite how spiritual teachers operate. And they did. And so it's much more common to have sort of circles of authority where everybody had a say in how things were going. And it sort of removed this, any sort of spiritual hierarchy. And there were a lot of problems with doing that because, again, some of those hierarchies are growth hierarchies. Some are dominator hierarchies, pathological hierarchies. Those you have to address. Growth hierarchies, you don't want to stop because you stop growth if you do that. But it was a real problem. It was a real issue. And that just tended to be part of one of major, major issues that spiritual teachers had if they didn't address their own shadow material. And that's a genuine issue. It was also a problem because they weren't addressing growing up either. And so just like, I mean, the worst case scenario we saw, you're Ram Dass's brother and you end up institutionalized because you're just at an egocentric stage and you think you're Jesus Christ. But it was very common for Eastern teachers to be at ethnocentric stages of growing up simply because their cultures largely were. And that turned out to be a real problem. And some of those got caught up in cultic activity because then that particular group's teacher was the one and only teacher. It was the teacher that was going to bring enlightenment to the entire world. And those kinds of groups got into big trouble fast. And we had to just sort of rewrite the rules for all of that. It still isn't done nearly as good as it could be done, because all that developed really were sort of a set of rules that helped keep the excesses of low levels of growing up and serious shadow problems. It just sort of, it didn't cure those. It just sort of recognized them and kept them out. And that's about the best that we've come up with in most of the Western disciplines that we have. So it would just be a lot better when not only are people learning waking up process, but they're also learning how to spot certain growing up in general, and also just learning some simple, straightforward aspects for shadow material and how to deal with that, because those are areas that continually still get enormously messed up, and it's a real problem.
Yeah, it seems that in a lot of the kind of spiritual traditions, they don't even address shadow material as a problem, because sometimes there's the belief that enlightenment equals perfection, that a person just can do no wrong when they reach a certain level of realization, which in practice, I would say, is untrue.
Right. Well, that was part of the problem, particularly with Eastern tradition, because most of the Eastern traditions, some of the Western ones, but almost all of the Eastern traditions really did go back to a period where, in terms of waking up, we talked about those two major steps of waking up. One is just pure awareness without any objects arising. And then one is pure oneness, where you're one with everything that's arising. Most of the great spiritual traditions in the East started with just getting into that state of pure awareness. And you can actually do that in certain types of yogic states of consciousness, where you'll get into that state of nothing arising, so much so that it's very much in a sense like being in deep dreamless sleep. You're simply in this pure, unmanifest realm, and nothing is arising. There are no objects arising anywhere in your awareness. You're just in this deep, formless, unmanifest state. We actually saw examples of this with the Vietnam War, when monks who wanted to protest the war would get into the lotus position, then get into this unmanifest state. And that unmanifest state, by the way, really was the state of pure nirvana. That's what nirvana was. It was a state split from samsara, which was the manifest realm of finite individual objects and things. That was all bad. You were to get rid of that. And you got rid of that samsara by getting into nirvana. And technically, it was called nirodha, or just cessation. And so these Vietnamese monks would get into that state of cessation. And in that state, it's really like deep dreamless sleep. You can't feel any pain. There's no ego. There's no desire. There's no objects arising at all. And to demonstrate this, they had their bodies doused in gasoline and set on fire. And they all burned to the ground in ashes, and not one of them even flinched. I mean, nirvana is a very, very real state, and you can get into that. But then when Nagarjuna brought over that notion of non-duality, then that meant that there was a deeper state of awareness that you can get into. And that's where you still have that freedom of nirvana. But the entire world of samsara is also arising, and you're one with all of it. That's the non-dual state. And so famously, the Heart Sutra described that by saying, that which is emptiness is not other than form. That which is form is not other than emptiness. So emptiness was this pure, unmanifest, formless state, and form was all of these objects and things arising. But now those were not two. You actually had to find the unity of those. And it meant that nirvana is not other than samsara, and samsara is not other than nirvana. Now, when that happens, then all of a sudden, this whole world of form keep in mind that the earliest traditions, including the earliest forms of yoga and a lot of the earliest forms of spiritual traditions in the West, had you getting out of the manifest form of samsara entirely. You're in an unmanifest cessation. Nothing is arising. And so, because that was the highest state that was taught and transmitted, then all the teacher had to know is how to get you into that state. Your teacher didn't have to know anything about the world of form, because that's all samsara. That's all illusion. That's not real. We don't have to know anything about that. So your teacher doesn't have to know anything about shadow material or anything about sexual abuse or anything about science or anything about politics. Forget it. Just get into this unmanifest state and you're home free. Well, that changes when all of a sudden emptiness and form are not two. And then all of a sudden, what we are starting to get then is the notion that, okay, I'm going to get this enlightenment from my guru. And that means I'm going to be moving around in this world of samsara. I'm going to be moving around this world of form. And I have to interact with people. And somehow I have to learn how to do all of that from an enlightened point of view. And the only problem is the master, the teacher, the guru is not necessarily learning how to do all of that stuff. Because for the great portion of his or her own tradition, that stuff is just all completely unreal. You didn't need any of that at all. Now all of a sudden you do. And now all of a sudden teachers don't know what the hell they're doing out there. And so they're certainly not understanding stages of growing up, and they're certainly not understanding shadow material, and they're not understanding cleaning up. So this is becoming a real problem. And the more that would start to happen, then the common interpretation was, well, it's going to look like the guru is making mistakes. But actually, that's just your ego. Every mistake you see in the guru is your ego, because the guru is perfect and the guru can do no wrong. And so if you see something that looks wrong, like the guru hitting on a 15-year-old girl, that's just your ego. You're doing something wrong. You have to rework your awareness so that that's not an issue. And that became a part of the practice that a fair number of students were subjected to. And so if your teacher was alcoholic, that they're still perfect. That's nothing wrong with that. It's your ego is doing something wrong to think that's a problem. You're dealing with an enlightened person here. They don't make mistakes. So, yeah, I know he's sleeping with 14 students, but that's not a problem. If you think it's a problem, that's your ego. Fix it. So we had, I mean, some of the really enlightened people in the Western Hemisphere, including, to name some names, Adi Da, Trungpa, were drunken womanizers and had some of the most bright, awakened students you can find. I mean, it was really weird, to put it mildly. But that was and it's still common for people that don't understand that, wait a minute, your guru, if he or she is really going to help you with these other areas, then they have to learn about growing up. They have to learn about cleaning up. They have to learn about showing up. They have to learn about opening up, because it doesn't come with waking up. Waking up won't tell you any of that. And so they're not going to know that. And by the way, neither are you as their student. So that's an issue.
Yeah, it makes sense why you would want to integrate all these different growth hierarchies, because if one of them gets left at a really low developmental stage, it just causes pathology the higher the other ones develop. Because if they're all kind of roughly at the same level, it kind of seems to maybe mesh together a bit better. But if they become really developed in one area, and especially if they're getting publicly recognized as being really developed in that area, they can get away with all kinds of misbehavior.
Yeah. And there are a fair number of individuals in pretty much every major religion nowadays that explicitly do take an approach that we just call integral spirituality. And that's gone from people like Father Thomas Keating, who was an amazing, closest thing I've seen to a genuine Christian saint. He just recently died. But he had introduced centering prayer into Christians, which is a really profound form of Christian meditation. He also used all the stages of growing up exactly as I had presented them, and he used all of them, all the way down to Zen masters who are doing the same kind of thing. And so we're seeing this in a lot of places, and that's really very encouraging, because I call some of these like stages of growing up, for example, by the really clunky phrase conveyor belt, because if you're actually in a spiritual tradition, for example, that recognizes not only you have these states of waking up, and that's one of the things that we want to try to do here, but you do have shadow material and you do have to work with that. And there are stages of growing up. You're going to be going through those in any event. So you might as well learn about them now and make those part of your conscious growth. And that's what's happening. So that would really make, instead of religion being what it is today, which is in too many cases, it's a practice that fixates people at lower stages of development, magic or mythic, usually. And that's not a good thing to have happen. But instead, this would be a spiritual practice that would help them grow up as well as wake up and clean up. And that would really change the face of what religion does in today's world. It would make a huge difference. It would be extraordinary.
Yeah, this has been awesome to have you. Like, we've been following your work for so many years now, and it's nice to get it straight from the source. And I feel like there's ways that, I mean, this has been going on for so long. I'm just looking at the big Akel chart here, but I feel like there's ways to communicate these in animations and in a lot more depth, visually speaking, that, we just feel like we should be compelled to do that and help this.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be great. Mm-hmm. I mean, any of that type of elucidation, explanation, and particularly other types of medium, like visuals or computer programs or any of that, mm-hmm. I think all is absolutely fantastic. And again, the thing that I keep repeating is this isn't just presenting, a Wilbur viewpoint. As I said, all of these areas, as you can tell from what we've discussed, they're already there. They're lying around. There's an overwhelming amount of evidence for every one of them. As Jordan Peterson would say, they're not deniable. And these are just truths that really are not deniable in certain ways. And I didn't invent them. I have done what I can to draw them together and show how they're all important. So in a certain sense, it's just kind of, passing on the word of extraordinary human beings. And these are discoveries that some of them go back tens of thousands of years. So it's really quite astonishing, actually.
It is. Thank you.
Great, thanks.
Awesome.
Thank you all. And I will see you around, I do hope.
All right, thanks for being with us for the last 5 episodes. This was a really big one with Ken Wilber. You can find the entire interview in audio and video format at futurethinkers.org/Ken Wilber. And don't forget to register for the Future Thinkers membership and get access to our courses, private group calls, podcast extras, and more. Just go to futurethinkers.org/register. We're closing in 2 days. Get our 50-page guide on adapting to the future. Sign up at futurethinkers.org/signup.
Upgrade your mental operating system, increase your personal sovereignty, and gain deeper self-knowledge with our courses in personal evolution. Register now at courses.futurethinkers.org. The brand new Future Thinkers members portal is now live. Develop your sovereignty and self-knowledge with our in-depth courses, get access to our weekly sense-making calls, join the Q&As with past podcast guests, and much more. Become a Future Thinkers member today at futurethinkers.org/members. To stay up to date with new episodes, subscribe to Future Thinkers on your favorite platform. And leave us a review or a like. It really helps out the show. And don't forget to share this episode on social media.